We've been spending the last several weeks with Jordan Maxwell during this hour, and we're going to get to something tonight that he's wanted to talk about for quite some time. Hello, Jordan. How are you?
Well, fine, Jeff. I'm happy to be back here with you again.
Good.
Okay.
So what's on the agenda? We got a subject here that's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, well, you know what? We talked for a few moments about my experience with helping David Icke. I think I'm going to put that off till next week. I got a few other things I want to talk about this week.
Sure, sure.
You know, when I was a teenager, I was always very self-conscious of my ears protruded off of my head more than I would you know care to have, and I was always kind of self-conscious of that.
That was before before super glue came around. I remember.
Yeah, that's before super glue, and and so I always I always wanted to have an operation on my ears to pin them back, and so when I got married, I was about 26 years old, and I was out of work, a typical kid, 26-year-old, just got married and out of work. And so I was driving through Beverly Hills because it was supposedly a job I was going to go look at. And as I was driving through Beverly Hills that day, there was a high-rise right at this main cross-section in Beverly Hills, big streets. And on the top of the high rise is big sign saying a plastic surgeon. And I thought, that's what I want. I want a plastic surgeon. So I parked my car and went up and got in the elevator and went up to the top floor. And it was a very, very plush and big office. And so I went in and I told the girl there that I wanted to talk to the doctor. And she said, well, he is not here. He's at UCLA. He teaches plastic surgery to the, you know, he's a teacher of plastic surgery. And he's out at UCLA. He has his office out there. And so I said, well, I need to talk to a doctor. And so she said, well, I've got one here. So she called this other doctor, and he came out, and I told him what I wanted. And so he took some measurements on my ear and looked at it, and he said, well, that's no problem. I think we could do that. And so he said, I think it's probably going to be about $10,000 with the hospital and everything. It'll probably be about $10,000, a little over. And I said to him, I said, doctor, I am broke. I have no job. I have no money. I have nothing. I'm totally, got nothing, zero. And so he said to me, well, then why are you here? And I said, well, I think it's pretty obvious why I'm here. I need my ears worked on. And he mm-hmm. said, yeah, but how are you going to do that with no money? I said, oh, I'll show you. I said, where's the boss of this place? And he said, the doctor who owns this business is at UCLA. He's in charge of plastic surgery, a clinic at UCLA. This is uh-huh. many years ago. Uh-huh. And so he said, and he's very, very busy. I can answer your questions. I said, I don't need you to answer any questions. What I need is to talk to the doctor. And he said, well, you know, if you don't have any money, it's a waste of time. I said, how do you know that? You don't know that. And so the secretary is sitting listening to us. And I told the doctor, I said, look, all I want to do is just talk to the doctor. And so the secretary said, well, he's awful busy. I said, I didn't ask you if he was busy. I said, I want to talk to him. And so I knew I wasn't getting anywhere with them. So I said, look, I don't want to cause a scene. I don't want to be unkind, but I'm not leaving here, and I'm going to make a scene if I don't talk to the doctor. So get him on the phone, and I need to talk to him. And so the doctor shrugged his shoulders and said, okay, call him. What are you going to do? So she got on the phone, and she calls UCLA, and she gets the boss on the phone. And so she says, I have a guy here that needs to have his ears worked on. And her face lit up because the doctor told her he was getting ready the following week. He was getting ready to do a whole new class on plastic surgery at UCLA, and there were doctors coming from all over the world to learn the newest techniques, and he was the best, and he was the master. And so he said, he told her, put me on. So I got on the phone with him. And he said, you need ears worked on? I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, I need you. I've got everybody lined up for, to show the other doctors. But I don't have anybody, can't find anybody in Los Angeles who needs ears worked on. And I said, well, you're talking to him right now.
They don't call me Dumbo for nothing, right?
Right. And so he said, well, all right. He said, all right, you will be my patient on the ears. And so he said, and give me back to the secretary and I'll tell her.
That's funny.
And so I said, he said to me, he said, I'm going to do this operation because I'm using you. I'll do it for 1/3 of what it normally costs. And I said, no, doctor, no, you're not going to do it for 1/3. You're going to do it for free. I don't have a dime. I'm broke, got nothing, no job, nothing. And I said, and not only that, but I'm going to need hospitalization and other care after the operation. And you'll have to do that for free because I don't have anything. And he waited for a few moments. And he said, all right, put the secretary on the phone. And he told her, get him connected to the hospital and get him there now. And I'll take care of everything. It's going to be my expense. So I ended up going to Cedars-Sinai and having an operation like I wanted. And the doctor paid for everything, my hospitalization, all the other visits I had to go back two or three times.
Sure, follow-ups, of course.
And he was amazed, and I was too. But I got what I wanted. I went in there. I said I want to talk to the doctor. I did, and I got what I needed.
Another, it didn't cost me a nickel. Another cosmic Maxwellian encounter.
I mean, it was a silly kind of thing, but it.
That's Jordan.
Strange things happen around me, and so. And then I was thinking about a couple of other things. You know, when I first got married, my wife had a lady friend, an older couple, and she wanted to go visit them one night. And so we drove over to this old couple's home, and the old lady they were a very nice couple. And so my wife, when we got there, went into the kitchen with the old lady, and they were talking. And the husband wanted me to go see his ham operation. He had an enormous operation in his den of his home with all the equipment for radio and
sure.
And ham
yeah.
operator.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was just fascinated listening to him talking to people all over the world.
All over the world. That's an amazing ham radio.
Incredible. He was talking to people at the Vatican and on the ships at sea. And so I spent about a half an hour just sitting there listening to him and listening, watching him do what he's doing with the radio stuff. And then I decided to get up and wander around the house for a few minutes. And I went up into the front room. And the front room, he had been a merchant sailor. He had been a merchant seaman, and he had been all over the world. And because of that, he had been collecting all kinds of artifacts from all over the world. He had Africa, little statues and trinkets and all, you know, just all kinds of interesting little strange stuff that he's picked up in his life as a merchant marine. And but there was one thing in that front room that was overbearing. It was enormously important. It was a statue about 5.5 to 6 foot high of a dragon, and it was candy apple red, and I do mean flashy candy apple red.
That's pretty weird.
And it was a beautifully carved dragon, and it was like a big pillar sitting on the leaves and branches. All of that was hand carved, the leaves, the branches, and the big pillar, and this dragon was wrapped around it. And it was an extraordinarily beautiful thing, like I said, about 5.5, 6 foot tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was looking, the dragon was looking at the other side of the room, at the other corner of the room, and there was a window over there, so it looked like it was set up so he's looking out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walked up to this statue, and was looking at the art work of the base with all the leaves and grass and everything. It was all wooden carved. And so I was looking at the base, admiring the beauty of the handwork. And as I started, my eyes began to rise up and slowly but surely, seeing every little detail as I was raising my eyes up higher and higher to, and when I finally looked up at it, it was looking at me. It was looking directly at me, and my heart dropped into my stomach. I thought I was going to faint. I could not believe.
Did you say anything? No.
It just leaves you speechless.
Wow.
No, it was totally speechless. But when I walked in, it was looking, it's a wooden statue, and it's looking over to the other side of the room.
Got it.
And when I'm standing there looking at the base, and then as I continue to raise my eyes higher and higher, mm-hmm. looking at this thing, when I saw the face, it's looking at me. And I felt the adrenaline go through my body. I felt the fear just went all through my body. And I was shaking, and I left out of the front room, and I went back to the kitchen, and I told my wife, I said, "We have to go now." And she said, "And she said, okay, in a few moments." And I said, "No, I said now. That's N-O-W, immediately. We have to go." And so she didn't like it, and I said, "I don't care if you don't like it. We have to go." So she came with me, and we got in the car, and we left. I was shaking. And I never told her what I had seen and what happened to me, because, you know, I had already problems with my wife trying to adjust mm-hmm. to the kind of life I live.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't want to tell her that because it really freaked her out. And so, no, that's just one more strange thing that scared me to death.
That's a good one. That's wild. Did you ever go back?
No, I would never go back to that place ever again. I just mm-hmm. thought, I don't know what that was. I don't know who was playing tricks on me, but any time a wooden statue turns around and looks directly at me, I'm never going back, ever.
So, well, it's like one of those stories, look what I got at the garage sale, and the thing has a mind of its own.
Exactly.
Wild.
That's exactly what it was. You know, people say, look at this beautiful statue I bought in China. Yeah. Well, you know, don't be surprised if it comes alive.
That's really amazing, Jordan. You don't exaggerate, and that's a stunner.
It was a frightening experience to me because I was only 26 years old, and I'm not expecting that. My eyes were just generally starting from the bottom of the statue and going up.
Then
when I looked up, finally I looked up into the face, and it's staring at me.
Well, divorce by statue, right?
And it scared me. My heart dropped in my stomach, and I felt dizzy, and fear went all through my body. And all I knew is I got to get my wife and get out of here. And so I've lived through a lot of that kind of thing, but that was just one more experience.
That's a good one.
Yeah, and did I ever tell you about the ghoul that hit our town in Pensacola?
The ghoul?
A ghoul, G-H-O-U-L.
No. No. I like ghoul stories.
Oh, yeah, well, this is one, because when I was about 16, 17 years old, Pensacola in Florida, and you could go on the web and just type in Pensacola ghoul, mm-hmm. and there's all kinds of articles about it, but most of them were just professional articles from newspapers and magazines, but I lived it. I was there, and so what I've read on the web about it was nowhere near what I experienced myself. So we woke up one day, and in my hometown, I was about, like I said, 16 years old or more, and we found out that there were some bodies laying on the street where they had been eaten on, not you know, totally eaten, but eaten on. You could
nod.
Tell these were dead bodies. Mm-hmm. These bodies had been buried just recent, and whoever it was able to lift the big concrete covers for the graves, mm-hmm. very, very huge, heavy concrete covers, and whoever it was able to lift that concrete covers off and take the body out and drag it along and end up in the street somewhere, chewing on it and eating on it, and then left the body lay there. And so it didn't take long for the town to flip out because everybody was talking about this ghoul that's robbing graves and eating on the bodies and leaving the bodies. And they were,
Did you see these?
No, I didn't see them. No, but everybody, it was all in the papers, it was in magazines, and people talking on the radio about it. And being a Navy town, it was a very military town. And so all of a sudden, the military is out every day, every night. You would see military jeeps and half trucks and all kinds of military presence, because the military jumped in to protect the town, and they were looking for this thing too, whatever it was. And so my girl cousin, we would go over to my aunt's house because they had a big heavy duty big house, and my family would go over there for sometimes dinner with my aunt and uncle.
Right.
And so my girl cousin, her boyfriend was a deputy sheriff. And so when he would come over for dinner, either going to work or coming from work, he'd come over to the house. And so we we could sit and talk with the deputy sheriff about what's going on. And he was telling us all kinds of strange stuff that the sheriff and the police were finding and that the military were finding. And
Wait. What other kinds of strange things?
Well, he was opening
up his knowledge of the local X-Files to you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But he didn't tell us a whole lot, but we knew from hearing all the reports during the day and the radio and the newspapers, and then talking to him, and he was telling us, no, this is legitimate. We don't know what this thing is, but it's not human, because humans don't do this kind of thing. And so, supposedly the military or the police or whoever it was set a trap for that creature.
The ghoul.
They faked the story, saying that they said, my cousin's boyfriend said that what they decided to do, what law enforcement decided to do, was to wait until someone passes away again And when they do, they're going to be buried at Whitmire Cemetery. And we've already, the city's already set this up. Mm-hmm. So they will put it into the paper immediately. A new person has passed away. And then it will, that person will be buried at Whitmire Cemetery. And so that's to alert this animal, this creature, to where his next victim will be. And he said, so they've already set this up. They've got lights ready.
This was military?
This was the military, the Navy. And also the police.
What year would this have been, Jordan,
this
approximately?
Probably about 56, 57, okay. Something like that.
All right.
And so, you know, my dad and I and my uncle wanted to go out there to the cemetery to see what was going on. My cousin's boyfriend said, that's not very wise. You can do it, but if you do it, you better go in the back way and don't go inside the cemetery, because that place is crawling with people waiting for something to happen, and there are sharpshooters there, and the place is
really light. This was a big deal then.
So we heard again that he had whatever this creature was, he had struck again. And I guess they were firing at him, shooting at him, and it didn't hurt him, because my cousin's boyfriend said, we shot him so many times. Military did, Navy did, the sheriff's people, the cops, shot this creature many, many times. We hit him, didn't seem to bother him at all. He ran and was able to go over the fence.
How did this guy talking to you describe what the ghoul looked like?
Well, they said it looked like a man. It was built like a man.
Right.
But it was obviously, if it's a man, it's one that needs to be put away somewhere. And and maybe it's not a man. Maybe it's, something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually that happened, where they finally, ganged up on it, and it ran. And they set the dogs on it, but it was the thing was able to outdo the dogs and outsmart the dogs.
So you talked to the one guy who actually was involved with shooting.
Yeah,
right?
He was a deputy sheriff.
Yeah, and he said this really happened.
Right, it really happened.
He shot at it. Wow.
Yep.
Well, how did he look? What did he say? Was he scared? Was he perplexed? Was he worried?
He was perplexed, but he's a sheriff's deputy, so that's for him to handle. I mean, that's what he does for a living. Yeah. So we'll talk about more of it when we come back.
Very good. Yeah. All right. Bedtime Stories with Jordan Maxwell. More coming up. Okay, and we're back with Jordan. All right, great stories tonight. Go ahead, Jordan.
Yeah. Back in 2010, I was homeless again, and I had to move out. And I got a little small room in the backyard of a bigger house. And it was just a room, but it had everything I needed. And so I worked on the place to, you know, clean it up and repaint it, etc., and got it really nice and comfortable.
Sure.
But there was a piece of molding that was floor molding under the sink, and it was falling. It was falling apart, and so I glued it back in, put some glue on it, and glued it back in. So, and then a few days later, it's laying on the floor again. So then I put double amount of glue, the wheel hole, that really strong stuff, and put it on there and tacked a few little nails into it to hold it. And a couple of days later, I came home, and there it is laying on the floor again.
Hmm.
And so then I went out and got the hammer and nails, and I nailed it back in. I mean, four or five nails, I nailed that molding. It's not going to fall anymore.
Uh-huh.
And so I was sitting at my desk and working, and all of a sudden one night I'm sitting there working, and all of a sudden I hear the loudest crash, like a car hit my room, like a car ran through, and mm-hmm. it just a loud thunderous crash.
Hmm.
And it scared me to death, and I jumped around to see what was wrong, and there was the molding on the floor again.
Wow.
And, I had put a bunch of nails in to make sure.
Uh-huh.
But no, it was a loud crash, and there was the molding on the floor.
Well, whoever used to live in there obviously didn't want it up there.
I guess not, because somebody was saying, you can do whatever you want, son, but this is not going to be.
Did you tell the owner about that?
Yeah, I did, but there's nothing she could do.
Did she believe you?
Huh? No.
Did she believe you?
Oh, I don't know if she did or not. I just told her what happened.
Hmm.
But, it doesn't mean anything. That and $2 will get you a cup of coffee, but... I know that there was a message in that, because the sound was so loud. It was absolutely thunderous. And so it made the point. Somebody is saying, no, you're not going to put this molding up. I don't care how you do it. And the other thing I was going
to
bring up.
I remember when you were living in that place, come to think of it. You used to call me from there.
I don't think
you told me about that, though.
Oh, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I don't recall, but that did scare me, because
you used to call me from every one of your places. Jordan's moved around a lot.
Well, yeah, I have to when you're homeless.
When you're poor,
you don't have any,
When you're poor and you're homeless, you got to move. You got to keep moving.
That's right. That's right. And then I would get a place. Somebody would give me a room to let me live in a room with their house, and then the house would sell.
Yeah.
So they have to move. That means I got to move again. I have to call around to my friends and try and find another room. And then I get there for 6 months or 5 or 6 months. And then they decided they're going to leave and go someplace else. So I've got to leave too. And so that's the way life has been for me since 1988, 89. I have been totally homeless. And so I don't care anymore. I just do the best I can.
Well, the universe is ultimately taking care of you, though, because you're not on the streets, and you have had a lot of very nice people.
That's right.
Bring you
in
and provide basics for you. And I mean, you're a treasure, and I just can't imagine why this has been your lot in life. It's not right, but it has, and you've survived it, so...
Yeah, I've been sued and lied to.
Oh, I don't even go there.
All kinds of stuff. My life has been stolen from me, and all kinds of things have happened to me. But my feeling is I've been put here to do something, and that's what I, you know, like the Apostle Paul quoted in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul said, "Am I only to take what is good from God? Or am I also to take whatever he gives me?"
Mm-hmm.
So it may be good, it may be bad, but it's still God is giving it to you, so don't complain. And
you never really have complained. No, not to me. I mean, we've discussed these things at great length, but You've never complained. You've carried this load remarkably gracefully. And,
well, because I just feel that it's something I'm supposed to do, and that's who I am. That's the life I chose, or that's the life that's been given to me. So there's no use in complaining about it. I am who I am, and I've done what I've done. So,
yeah. Well, at least you got the ears fixed. Come on.
Yeah, I was going to tell you a little bit. I guess we got a few minutes. I'll tell you.
Oh, we got about 15 minutes.
Yeah, well, I think that'll be enough, hopefully.
We'll make it 16 then. How's that?
Well, it's about experiences with David Icke. Back in 1992, I got a job with a publishing house in San Diego called Truthseek.
Yep.
And I was pretty much like an ideologue. I was kind of like in charge of the whole place. There was a lady who was running it, but she let me pretty much run the place the way I wanted to.
Right.
And the company was a for-profit publishing house, but they had like $24 million in the bank and a public trust fund, so that they would get the interest divided into 12 equal payments, and so that no matter if they made money or they didn't make any money, it doesn't matter because they're getting almost $100,000 a month, to make sure that the company would always have plenty of money to do what it wanted.
Sure.
And so I got a job there as a religion editor for the magazines and for the company. And then I also ended up being kind of like an ideologue. They pretty much let me do whatever I wanted to do. And so I was financing everybody. I was giving money to all kinds of writers and researchers and promoting people on radio and television. And I was having a great time being generous with everybody and helping all my friends.
Well, you used to call me when you were down there, too. I remember all this.
Yeah. Yeah, and so one day a young girl came in to visit. She called me and said she wanted to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
She was from England and she needed to talk to me. So I said, okay, so come over. And she did, and she brought a young man with her. Her name was Alice Ferguson, and the guy's name was David Griffin, I think it was, David Griffin. And so she's telling me that her friends in the UK told her to come to America and go to San Diego and meet Jordan Maxwell because he seems to have a line on money and he's being very generous with everybody and helping to finance people's careers and get them, get their books published and everything. And so she said, and so that's why I'm here. And she said, I come here because I wanted you to help me promote my friend David Icke. And I didn't know who he was. I have no idea. So I said, well, who is this David Icke, and why, what do we need to
promote? What year was this again? 99?
No, it was about 92.
Oh. Had to be way early. Yeah, I heard you wrong. Okay.
Yeah, it was about 1992, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, all right. And so we talked, and then she showed me a VHS of a little 10-minute lecture that David had done in England at some little group. And I liked him. I liked his style. I thought he was very intelligent. And so I said to her, all right, I will help you with him. And I said, here's what I will do. I will give you and your friend, David, I will give both of you a job. I will hire both of you to work for me, and I'll give you $2,500 $2,500 a month, $2,500 a month. That's $5,000 between the two of you. I'll give you a job, and you work for me doing promotions and doing what I need done, because I was going to hire somebody anyway. So I'll hire you, and now you've got a job. And I will give you the credit card on the foundation. The foundation has a lot of money, and I'll give you the credit card so that you can promote David Icke and everything else I want you to do. You use the credit card, And so now you've got a job. Well, that means also, I told her, well, that means tomorrow I'm going to have to find you an office here in the building. And, of course, with the office, I got to get your computers and phones and printers and all of that stuff. So that's going to be another expense. And so I'll get you an office. You'll both have an office to yourself, and I'll outfit the office for you. And then of course so I asked her, where are you going to stay? And she said, well, we don't have a place right now. So I said, oh, okay. Then what I'll do is I'll get both of you, one bedroom apartment apiece, and we'll pay for it. The foundation will pay for it. So, go out and look and find an apartment. And so she said, well, we can't go out because we don't have a car. So I said, all right, I'll lease you a new car tomorrow. I'll go with you. I'll lease you a new car. I'll give you some cash. Go out and find the place you want, and then come back, and I'll get it for you. And then the company will pay for it.
Right.
So I got him a new car. I give him a job, $2,500 a piece each month, mm-hmm. plus their own office, and mm-hmm. plus their own one-bedroom apartments. And then I said to them, I said, well, you're going to need furniture and everything. So I give them both $3,000 in cash to go out and buy furniture for their apartment. So both of them had $3,000 to go out and buy stuff. And so they were very happy. They should be. I was financing them and giving them gold credit cards and all that. And so then I noticed after about a month or so that she, Alice Ferguson, was going on long trips. She would fly to Australia to have David Icke come to Australia to do seminars, and then go to Canada and back to Europe again. And so she was really running up the bills on the credit card, but I don't care, as long as she's doing what I want, as long as she's taking care of the business. And so she was slowly but surely spending a lot of money on promoting David Icke, getting him on radio and TV. And, of course, he has to have a car when he gets into some place, wherever he's going. And he has to stay in a hotel. He needs money. And so she was giving him whatever he needed. And it costs money if you're going to set up a seminar, right? Because if you got a theater, the theater wants insurance on the theater in case somebody dies or something. So if you're going to have a lot of people there, you better have insurance on the building. Well, that's, she just puts that on the credit card. So the bottom line is I'm watching the bills as they come in. She's going to France. She went to Spain, then she flew to England, and then she has a girlfriend. She brought a girlfriend back, and so she brings a girlfriend to meet me, and she said she really needs a job. So I said, all right, I'll give her a job, but I'm just going to pay her $1,000 a month, but I'll get her a room, I'll get her an apartment. A one-bedroom apartment,
right?
And I said, but you have to take care of the three of you with the new car, because I'm only getting you one new car. And so I gave her the keys to it. Well, the second part of the story is that she was doing fine. She's traveling all over the world with her girlfriend. And they're going here and going there and taking trips, and they're going to see David Icke here. They're going to take David Icke there. And so I'm busy. I'm roaming around the country taking care of business. I'm up in San Francisco. I went to Canada to do some business there. And so once a month, there would be a paycheck. When you come into the office, each one of us had a folder for our paychecks and for our mail.
Right.
And so I came in one day after traveling for a couple of weeks. I came at the end of the month, and my paycheck wasn't there. And so I asked Nancy, the secretary, I said, did you guys get paid? And she said, oh, yeah, everybody got paid. I said, no, not everybody. I didn't get paid. And so I didn't say anything. I just walked on into my office. I figured that, Bonnie's probably forgot about it or whatever, but I don't have time to fool with it. And so I had to go back out the next day in San Francisco. And so I'm paying for my own airfare, my own hotel. And so I didn't even think about it because I was so busy. until I came back in town at the end of the end of that month, and I walked into the office, and everybody's been paid, but still, I don't have a paycheck. So then I said, wait a minute, Nancy. I said, what's going on here? Where everybody's been getting a paycheck. Where's mine? And she said, oh, no, we fired you 2 months ago. You've been fired for a couple of months. I said, what are you talking about? She said, no, no, we got rid of you. You're fired. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, I'm telling you, Bonnie fired you. And I asked her, I said, why would Bonnie fire me? And she said, because Alice Ferguson suggested that Bonnie fire you and bring David Icke in to take your place, because all the women love David Icke. And so why don't you just fire Jordan Maxwell, get rid of him, and bring David Icke in? So you're fired. You've been fired for 2 months. So now I go home broke. Because I've tapped my credit card out.
Yeah, I remember this very well.
And I had no place to go. I have no money. And so I have to call my friends in Los Angeles to see who will give me a room, who will put me up. And Vladimir Tuzinski, my dear friend from Eastern Europe, a scientist, Vladimir gave me a room gave me his room. He lived in a one-bedroom apartment. He gave me his room. He bought food. He gave me and drive me around, take me around to wherever I needed to go. He saved my life. And so I had a place to live until I could get back on my feet. But the bottom line on the story is that all that I gave Alice Ferguson, all that I gave them with money for apartments and new cars, and that's what I got for it. Alice Ferguson stabbed me in the back and got me fired, so I'm sleeping on the floor in Los Angeles with nothing for being so generous for her. So
Goes unpunished, Jordan.
I have had this kind of stuff happening to me continually, over and over and over again. And of course, I got a lot of people say to me, well, it's probably something you're doing. And I said, yes, it is. I'm trusting.
Yeah, you're being too damn kind. That's always been the issue.
And I want to try and help people.
Yeah.
And I'm always ready to give and to be generous. Yeah, I have a character flaw. And that's why I sleep on the floor broke with nothing. Because the people see in me a way to make a lot of money and rip the old man off and get rid of him and take the money. And so that's what I have put up with for all these many years. And so, but I have always known that there must be a reason why these things happen to me. And I know what it is. I'm totally sure I know what it is. I have cosmic companions. I've come here to do something of importance.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody knows that I'm here and they know what I'm doing. And they have the ability to throw me under the bus. And I'm talking about spiritual entities. I know that I have spiritual enemies. Too many things have happened to me.
Oh, they're black beings there that'll get in. Oh, yeah.
So I know that something evil is watching me and it is not impressed with what I do and wants me off the earth to destroy my reputation, to destroy my work. So I feel, I've been...
They're the enemies of light and knowledge and wisdom. Oh, my God, what you've contributed is enormous. And naturally, you would draw the dark side, which wants to rub that out. They don't want people to know the truth. They don't want people to know how it's all run, who set it up. They don't want people to know that they're victims.
And the people, generally speaking, they don't want to know either. They don't care about
it. And now more or less than ever, they just have no interest.
None,
just bumbling
none at
along.
All.
Not all, but most of them are just bumbling along like things, they call it flotsam and jetsam. They're just floating along, banging into the shore, banging into each other. There's no purpose. They're not fit for purpose, as Tim
exactly
Refat would say. They just aren't.
I always try, and I've said to so many people over the time that, I'm not here talking to you because I happen by chance to have been born. Most people are here because they just happen by chance to have been born. No, I am here as a teacher. I've come here. and spent 60 years of my life preparing myself to be who I am in this particular time in which we are now living, in which the world is now caught up in demonic darkness, evil, treachery, and people of the world do not know how this stuff works and where it's come from and where it's going. So that's what I'm here to do.
And no one does it like you, Jordan. Nobody. Nobody. Thank you for sharing that. It's not fun to do, and I do remember it quite clearly. I remember Vladimir and all that. You have surmounted things that very few people could handle, and you sound wonderful, as always.
Well, I did it because there are people like you who helped me, and I appreciate it.
Jordan, you go get some rest, and we'll talk next time. Thank you. Thank you, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Jordan Maxwell. There's only one Jordan Maxwell. Okay, we'll be back in 21 hours. Let's see, what is tomorrow? So, okay. Tomorrow night, looks like, good lineup. Well, I'll keep it a secret. Talk to you tomorrow night. Thanks for being here, and thanks for all the kind words in our second hour tonight. I won't forget them. Talk soon.